So welcome, everyone, for our sixth and final class for this year, 2022-5782, Book of Esther, Part 6. So I am going tonight to address the following question. How come this amazing holiday, maybe some of your favorite holidays of the year, Purim may be right at the top of your list, it isn't at the top of my list. Why is the holiday called Purim? So we're going to explore this question tonight. It's a real question. The word pur seemingly comes from the word lottery. A lot, because Haman threw lots. But why would you name the entire holiday Purim? So let's look at this direct quote, okay, from the Megillah. It's from Esther 9, chapter 9, verses 24 to 26, okay? So I'll read it to you in the English. Ready? And this will give us the genesis of the name Purim. This is after Haman has been defeated, the 10 sons have been destroyed, his followers are destroyed, the Jews win. For Haman, the son of Hammedata, the Agagite, the adversary of all the Jews, had devised to destroy the Jews. And he cast the poor, like the word Purim, that is the lot, to terrify them and destroy them. And when she came before the king, a reference to Queen Esther, he commanded through letters that his evil decree that he had devised against the Jews return upon his own head, Haman's own head, and to destroy him and his sons on the gallows. Therefore, they called these days Purim, after the name Pur, lottery. Therefore, because of all the words of this letter, and what they saw concerning this matter, and what happened to them. So there is the source for everyone at home. Sorry, I didn't scroll down far enough. So let us now clarify the question at hand, okay? So 1967 was the most miraculous war of our lifetimes. The Six-Day War. That's how it became known as, the Six-Day War. What if, though, you're trying to name the war? Right? The PR people are behind the scenes, you know, Schwartz, Schwartz, and Schwartz, you know, the famous advertising firm. Schwartz, Schwartz, and Schwartz. So the phone rings at the PR firm, Schwartz, Schwartz, and Schwartz. Man answers the phone. And the guy on the phone says, is Mr. Schwartz there? Man says, no. Is Mr. Schwartz there? No. Is Mr. Schwartz there? Yes, yes, speaking. Schwartz, Schwartz, and Schwartz. Okay. It's cute. Think about it for a moment. So Schwartz, Schwartz, and Schwartz, the PR firm, decides, you know, it's a great miracle, happened in 6 days, so let's call it the Six-Day War. And then somebody else at Schwartz, Schwartz, and Schwartz says, you know, I don't know. The Arabs had the Kalashnikov rifle, very formidable weapon, and we somehow beat them. And then somebody else says, no, no, even more formidable was the tank, the T-55 Russian tank that the Syrians use and that we destroyed in the Sinai and Syria. Let's call it the T-55 war. So you'd be like, what? So we're going to name the holiday or the great momentous occasion of the miracle after the failed weapon of the bad guys, of the adversary. So isn't kind of that the same thing? So in other words, Purim happens, we win, Haman loses. What was the mechanical, or you may say, astrological little gimmick that he'd use to try to ascertain when to kill the Jews? He uses the lottery, the poor. So therefore, we call the day of the Kalashnikov, the day of the T-55, the day of the lottery. But it didn't work for Haman. So you're not naming it for a Jewish occasion. You're not saying it's the Esther holiday. It's Mordechai and Esther day. That would be reasonable. We have a fast name for Esther, so why not name it Esther Day? She's the heroine, right? Think of something Jewish. So the best you can do, the PR firm of Schwartz, Schwartz, and Schwartz there in Shushan, the best you can do is call this day after the failed lottery that he threw, which is kind of weird because the whole concept of coincidence and chance is antithetical to Judaism. We believe in divine providence and that God plays a role. God plays a tremendous role behind the scenes. So why not call the holiday, let's say, the hidden hand of God, right? Because Esther's name means hidden. So it's hidden. Mask, the holiday of masks, whatever. But Purim? What's going on? So do you all hear the question? How come we call the name of the holiday, this great, wonderful day, after the failed lottery of Haman? So we have to answer this question. In order to answer this question, we're going to go way off the reservation, ladies and gentlemen. Okay? So let's go to source number 2. And I'll just read it to you in the English. Now, where we're going to go is somewhere really off. You know how sometimes rabbis like to go far off the reservation in order to bring back the story? So we're going to go to the book of Numbers. So that's Bamidbar in the Torah. And we're going to go to chapter 30, Perek Lamed. And this is a whole story about vows. So we know vows are a big thing, right? Because the most famous night of the year is Kol Nidre. Kol Nidre, all vows. And we talk about anything I said out loud and I didn't fulfill the vow, or maybe I didn't do it correctly. God, please forgive me and may the vow be nullified. Okay? So here's the rule. If you have a husband and a wife, and the wife makes a stupid vow, an injurious vow, something she says, I don't want to get benefit from, and whatever it is, if she was allowed to go ahead with this vow, it would actually hurt her. So there's a small window of opportunity where if the wife or a daughter who is under a certain age, under 12, who is still like a minor or a na'ara, a young lady of 12 to 12 and a half, her dad, like the husband, has the ability for a very short time to disagree with the vow, and he has the power, the husband does, to nullify the vow. Now, you might say, Rabbi, does this have anything to do with Purim? No. But it will. So let me just read you very quickly, source 2 in English. You ready? But if she, this is the woman, the wife, bowed in her husband's house, or imposed a prohibition upon herself with an oath, and her husband heard and remained silent. He heard whatever she made a promise. I'm going to, right? I'll never touch pasta again. And the husband remained silent and did not hinder her. All her vows shall stand, and every prohibition she imposed upon herself shall stand. But if her husband revokes them on the day he hears them, anything issuing forth from her lips regarding her vows or self-imposed prohibitions shall not stand. So on the day that she makes the vow, there's like a 24-hour window, and if the husband gets wind of this vow, he has the power to help his wife get out of it. Say, dear, this is not good for you. You love, you know, General Hospital, all my children, and you said you're never going to watch a soap opera again. I know that you mean well, but I'm saying that you can watch soap operas. It's okay to watch Dallas and Dynasty next week. Baruch Hashem, says the wife. Her husband has revoked them, and the Lord shall forgive her. And then it says, any vow or any binding oath of self-affliction. So this is where she's denying herself something that would literally cause maybe health issues or pain and suffering. Her husband can either uphold it, meaning do nothing and let the vow stand, or he has the power to revoke it. However, if her husband remains silent from day to day, he has upheld all the vows and prohibitions she has assumed. He has upheld them since he remained silent on the day he heard it. If he revokes them after having heard them, he shall bear her iniquity. Okay, turn the page. And for those that are watching on Zoom, let's go to source 3. So before we do source 3, let us just recap very quickly where we're holding. Okay? So the question at hand is, how come the holiday of Purim is named after a device, the lottery, that Haman rolled in order to ascertain through the gods of coincidence and chance what would be the appropriate month and day to kill the Jews? And we said how weird it is that when they were naming this holiday at the end of the book of Esther, that instead of choosing like Esther Day to celebrate the victory, they choose instead a name, Purim, which means lotteries. Like, what's going on? Why would you name it after Haman? Then we sort of went elsewhere. We went to the book of Numbers, and we talk about an interesting rule that a married woman, and this would also apply to a young girl, if she makes an injurious vow, let's say she says, she's just, you know, resentful that she's put on some weight. She says, okay, that's it. I am never eating carbohydrates again for long as I live. Now, it's a nice goal, but it's also something that could eventually hurt her. Let's say she's living in an area where, you know, rice and beans and you know, pasta, stuff like this, right? Let's say she's in Italy, right? She's making this type of vow. So the husband knows that, yeah, she means well, but it's not going to work. And then if she goes over, if you transgress your vow, if I vow to God, I say, in the name of God, I will never do X, Y, Z. If I then do this, I'm sinning. So it's not a good thing. So the husband has a 24-hour window to decide, you know what, this is not in the best interest of my wife, and I'm going to allow her a passage off. If she says, no, dear, I really want this, and they discuss it, obviously he doesn't have to do this. But he has the legal power, legal authority in the eyes of God, to sort of annul a vow that she would make in the moment. And we all do this, right? We all make vows. You make your little promises at New Year's, right? Your New Year's resolutions. I will resolve to do X, Y, Z. What if you made it in the name of God, though? That's why we never do this, right? That's what we always say. If you say something like, I will do it, we always use the word, you may have heard religious people say this, beli neder, but I'm not promising. Well, so some say, Rabbi, are you going to pick me up at 5 o'clock to go to the game? Yeah, beli neder, I'll be there. Because it's not my fault, and maybe I can't get there. So I'm not promising you, so I actually invoke that term, beli neder. Billy Nedder, that's the least joke. Billy Nedder means I'm not promising in the name of God that I'll just do my best. Then if I'm not there, something, an accident, and a hand of God intervenes and my car breaks down, then I'm not on the hook for a sin. I don't have to bring like a sacrifice, or I know my soul doesn't get punished. So that's the story here with the power of a husband with his wife. He has the power to get her out of trouble. Okay? Now what this has to do with Purim, we shall see. Okay, let us look now at source number 3. So what does it mean at the end of that long journey that we did in source 2 where it talked about the husband having this window of 24 hours from day to day to sort of make his wife's neder, her promise, her vow, go away? He shall bear her iniquity. He, the husband, takes her place. So if she makes a vow and he knows it's unrealistic that she can keep it, She doesn't get off. The vow is transferred. Whatever that issue is, whatever that sin is on his soul, it goes to him. He accepts responsibility for his wife's vow. So in other words, the vow doesn't just poof, go away in midair. The Torah, the Bible says that the vow goes from her to him. So whatever punishment is coming, it no longer goes to the young lady. It goes to the husband, which is kind of cool, right? He's accepting responsibility for his wife. Beautiful idea, right? Men taking care of women. And then it says like this. We learn from here that if someone causes his fellow to stumble, he bears his punishments in his place. So there's a concept, a beautiful concept. Alifnei iver lo titein michshol. You've probably heard this, right? You don't put a stumbling block in front of a blind person. So if I know that there is an issue at hand, and I have someone who's going to do that issue, and I say nothing, then I'm kind of morally responsible for not having stepped up and minimally telling the person, hey, you know, you may want to know, you know, there's an issue here. But if I say nothing, if I just let it go, I'm almost like putting a stumbling block for them to fall, not literally, but metaphorically, trip over something. So if I know that you shouldn't, you know, eat at a certain restaurant because maybe the kosher, the thing is not good, or maybe I hear that there's an issue with, you know, cleanliness or this or that, I owe it to you to tell you, you know what, you may not want to eat there. It's probably not a good thing. I don't have to spread gossip. I could just say, you know, I just want to let you know. I heard that I overheard you and you're going out to you know, Marino's for dinner. I just want you to know I heard something about the health department declaring an issue there with their kitchen, so you may want to reconsider. But if they go and they end up getting, you know, food poisoning or whatever it is, you didn't do right by that person, right? So in Jewish law, we want to help people and not put stumbling blocks in front of people. It's a very powerful idea that I have to look after my fellow human being. Beautiful concept. And it applies to a husband taking care of his wife. That if he knows that she is doing something injurious to herself, even if she means well, if the husband knows that by making a vow to abstain from X, Y, or Z, and he knows that tomorrow she'll regret it, then he should get her out of it. And by getting her out of it, he's taking the punishment on himself, which is kind of neat. Now, how does this relate to Purim? Well, let's have a look. Source 4. So this is that great moment that we had in a previous class where Esther the queen is scared to go to the king. So let's contextualize. Haman has sent out a letter. The letter is emblazoned with the special ring of the king, right? They had that signet ring, and they would put it into the wax, and they would seal that envelope, and that would show that King Ahasuerus has approved of this communique. Haman got the ring from the king. He now has license to send out, in the name of Ahasuerus, the letter. And what does the letter say? It's a little ambiguous, but it says on the 13th day of the coming month of Adar, the Jewish holiday, 11 months from now, be ready to fight. Be prepared to do the king's bidding. And then there was like an oral communique, because, you know, Nazis never like to put things in writing. So they just do it orally. And then they go, wink, wink, by the way, you know when it says you have to be ready to fight and kill? Obviously, we're targeting the Jews. So, you know what, we mentioned this. You ever hear of the Wannsee Conference? Yeah, it's not so famous. The Wannsee Conference. So the Wannsee was some resort somewhere. I'm sorry, I don't know where it is. I don't know if it was Austria, somewhere like in that, you know, Nazi homeland. And at that conference, I don't think Hitler Yimach Shemo attended in person, but Eichmann, who was the architect of the Final Solution, was there. Heydrich, his chosen one, was there. And essentially the Wannsee Conference was kept under wraps. There really weren't notes taken because they didn't want notes taken. And this is where the Final Solution was enacted, to kill the rest of the Jews that were alive still. Before that, it was bullets. And, you know, the Zyklon B gas hadn't really ramped up yet. You know, it was, Jews weren't worth the price of a bullet, so you had to come up with a more diabolical, mass-marketed way of killing the Jews. All of that. And Adolf Eichmann, Yimach Shemo, the architect of the Final Solution, he was there. But it was like sort of oral tradition. Whatever was discussed there, it really wasn't written down. So there's a lot of like supposition about what the Nazis talked about. They didn't want to have recriminations. And these are Nazis. They didn't want to be known, you know, 100 years from now, we eradicated the Jews. So you can imagine with Ahasuerus too, he doesn't want to be known as the king who eradicated an entire people. So he knows what Haman wants, but he doesn't want to put it in writing. So therefore, the letter that says, be ready to kill, doesn't say, oh, we're going to create Auschwitz and Birkenau for the Jews. He's smarter than that, and so is Haman. So the letter is sent, and Mordechai is desperate. So he gathers all the Jews of Shushan together. They put on ashcloth and ashes on their forehead, sackcloth and ash, and they go to shul, they go to the town square, and they're praying their hearts out to God, please help us. What are we going to do? Because they get wind of this letter, and they know what it means. 11 months from now, we're all dead. Okay. Mordechai communicates to Esther via an agent. Why? Because Haman's not an idiot. Haman has enacted the letter, yes. But he knows about the Jewish lobby. Those AIPAC boys were around back then. I mean, I'm joking. But AIPAC is going to try to, you know, get to the king. And the Jews are going to try to lobby the king to please stop this insanity. Don't kill the Jews, right? So Haman has taken precautions. Number one, he has, like, his agent sort of looking around the palace grounds to make sure nothing untoward is happening. And he also has planted ideas in the mind of King Ahasuerus that assassins are going to be after you. The Jews are going to hire John Wick to take you out. So you better, you know, lock yourself in. So he does. He locks himself in to his innermost chamber. And then they have a rule. No guests. Nobody can come see you. No Jews can come see you without a written invitation to come. And what happens if you knock on the door and barge in? Off with your head. No questions asked. Even the queen of the country. Esther wasn't invited. So she says to Mordechai, look, I know you want me to go lobby on behalf of the Jews, but this ain't the time. Because if I go, the only way out of it is if he lifts up his golden scepter and says, I favor you, come sit next to me, sweetheart. But at that point, I'm going to say what? Oh, I'm a Jew, by the way. You never knew this for 9 years. And by the way, my people are about to be killed. Kind of like, by you? I mean, what is she supposed to say? And then, please save the Jews? You know what? He might turn around and say, my dear, just be grateful. I just saved your life. Shut up. I'm not going beyond that. Just be happy I saved you. So it's not a good time for her to go, right? So she says this to Mordechai. And then Mordechai responds, and I'll read it to you. Source 4. Ready? And Esther said to Hatach, and she ordered him to tell Mordechai, all the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who comes to the king into the inner court who is not summoned, meaning not personally invited by King Ahasuerus, there is but one law for him to be put to death, except the one to whom the king extends the golden scepter, that he may live. But I have not been summoned to come to the king these 30 days. Number 5. I'll scroll down for everyone home. And they told Esther's words to Mordechai that she's I'm not going, she basically said. And Mordechai ordered to reply to Esther. Now, why are they communicating indirectly? Because Haman's lookouts are going everywhere. So what if the Jew and Queen Esther are seen together talking in silent, you know, like in a little corner of the courtyard? Haman's not an idiot. He's going to figure out something's up, and he'll take them out. So therefore, they are forced to use secretive measures to sort of communicate by a messenger. So the messenger comes back to Esther with the amazing words. Okay? Source 5. So when they told Esther's words to Mordechai, Mordechai ordered to reply to Esther. Look, Esther, just listen to these words. Amazing. Do not imagine to yourself that you, Esther, will escape in the king's house from among all the Jews. Meaning, just because you're the queen, you'll die too. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and rescue will arise for the Jews from elsewhere, and you and your father's household will perish. And who knows, Mordechai says to her, whether at a time like this, you will attain the kingdom. Maybe you're the queen just for this moment. Maybe that's why this is your destiny. And then Esther ordered to reply to Mordechai, okay, I'm going. But you have to do something for me, Esther says. Go, assemble all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast on my behalf, the fast of Esther. And neither eat nor drink for 3 days, day and night. Also I and my maidens will fast in a like manner. Then I will go to the king, contrary to the law. And if I perish, I perish. If I die, I die. Now these are like amazing lines, right? So let's just, we discussed this previously, but let's contextualize for those who were not here. So Esther's being told by Mordechai, look, my dear, you need this moment. I don't know why God selected you to be queen. We don't know. But it could be that this is the moment that you are uniquely capable of becoming the savior of the Jewish people. So if you want to go, it's for you. If you want to go, do it. But if you don't go, the Jews will still survive somehow. I don't know how, but Haman will not win the day. God has ordained that the Jewish people will win. Haman will lose. Now, Esther, this is your moment. What if you don't go? Okay. Somebody else will go. Or maybe Genghis Khan will come from the east, sack the kingdom in the next 11 months, wipe out Ahasuerus, you, Haman, and everybody else, and then no one's going to care about some dumb letter that was sent out to kill the Jews. Everyone will become a Hun, or whatever. It'll happen another way. Great. Mazel tov. Don't go, Esther. Do it for you or don't go. So listen to this. Normally, a person has three options in life. So let's say something really evil is going on. Boy, something evil going on right now, so you can understand where this is going. Something really evil is going on, okay? So you can either buy in and help, or you can stay out of it, or you can just sit on the sidelines and take it out. So you have three options. So Esther ostensibly has three options, three things that she can do. She could sit it out. But what about if she remains silent? So she's being told that remaining silent is tantamount to not just sitting it out, but you are actively participating in the destruction of the Jewish people. How do I know that? Because that's what happened with the father nullifying his daughter or his wife's vow. Do you remember we learned about it? Let's go back for a moment, okay? Shall we? Go back to source number 2. And I'm going to have to use a little Hebrew here. So I apologize for those who are not conversant in Hebrew. But we're going to source 2. And I'm going to highlight source 2 for those watching at home online, okay? Let me just, I think I can do this. I think I can actually... One second. I can make it highlight. There we go. Okay. I'm going to highlight here. So let's put a little highlight on here. Hand tool. Okay. Okay. All right. So when you're watching me at home, can you see where my little I'm having a problem with the add a little sticky note? Okay, so I'm having an issue trying to I'm putting a little sticky note where we are. Okay? So do you all see at home this is number two. It's on the first page. It's the little Hebrew paragraph about halfway down the page. Okay, I'm gonna read it to you now. Okay? But I'm gonna change it as I read it. Okay, watch this. This is the rule that we went over of a father, of a husband, having the ability for one 24-hour period to nullify his wife's neder. She makes an injurious vow, a vow that would be self-hurtful to her or that he knows she'll regret. He can nullify it for a one-day period of time. Okay, so let's read it. I'll read it to you. Ready? Ve'im beit isha, but if she in her husband's house made nidara, a vow, or asra isar al nafsha, or she imposed a prohibition upon herself, bishua, with an oath, vishama isha, and her husband heard the hecherishla, and he is silent about it, lo hiniota, and he doesn't hinder her, he doesn't get in her way. The wife makes a really dumb vow, and the husband chooses just to stay out of it. The kamakol nedara, then what's the rule? All her vows shall stand. V'cholisara shasra nasha yakum. Every prohibition that the wife took upon herself shall stand. Okay, now I want to point something out. This only works in the Hebrew. So for everyone here, if you will just read with me, and I'm going to... The third word is very critical, okay? V'im beit isha. But if in the house of her husband. Do you all see that the word isha, where I'm holding my mouse for you online, do you see that the hay has a little dot in the middle? Do you know what that dot is? It's called a mapik hay. A mapik hay. Special symbol in Judaism, how you read something.
You have to emphasize that, don't you?
Right. You read it as, oh, guttural, like, oh. So I'm reading it. Very good. You would read it like this. Ve'im beit isha nadara. But what is the purpose of that little dot, that little nakuda in the hay? You know what it does? It changes the meaning of that word totally. Because with the dot, it means her, possessive. Her ish, her husband. But what if there wasn't a dot there? What if it was just a plain hay, isha? Then it means woman. Wow. So one dot changes the meaning of the word from her husband to the woman. In the Torah, do we have dots? No. Now, I read it because I understand the tradition of how it was given to Moses. We read it with a dot. What if there wasn't a dot there? And again, in the Torah, there isn't a dot. Then it wouldn't mean her husband. It means if the woman is silent, the vow stands. Let me ask you a question. When you go to Mordechai, and I'm going to go to source number 4 now, okay? And again, I apologize for those here who are not Hebrew readers, but I'll do my best to explain it. I'll be okay. So we're on source 5 in the Hebrew, okay? Source 5 in the Hebrew, okay? All right. I'll read it to you in the Hebrew. Vayegidu leMordechai. I'm starting in source 5. Okay, you all see it? And they told Mordechai, eight divrei Esther, the words of Esther. Vayomer Mordechai. And Mordechai said, Lohashiv el Esther, to respond to Esther the following. Al tidami benafshech. He says to her, do not imagine to yourself, lehimaleit, that you will escape. Beit hamelech. From the house of the king, Mikola Yudim, from all the other Jews. Meaning you're going to die too if you sit this one out. And then look at these words. Ki im hacharesh tacharishi. For if surely you will be quiet, ba'et hazot, at this moment, it's over. Stop. There is only one other time in the entirety of the 24 books of the Torah where this phraseology, im hacharesh tacharishi, if you will surely be silent. Now in Hebrew, when they want to really emphasize something, it's called lashon kaful, they double down on it. So for example, in the Shema, they really want you to get to do the commandment, so it says, v'hayayim shamoa tishma'u, if you will for sure listen to God. So when it's like in English, if I said the word twice, I'm emphasizing it. Right? You better get this one right. So when I say it double, there's an emphasis there. Do it. So when it says, ha'im ha'charesh tacharishi, if you, Mordechai says to Esther, are quiet at a time like this. When is the only other time we have that language? We just read it. In the rules of a husband nullifying his wife's vows. So if you go back to source 2 in the Hebrew, okay, it's right there. You ready? It's on line number... It's the last sentence, second last sentence, on the fourth line down. I'm holding the mouse over there. On source number 2. Okay? It says, V'im, and if, these are literally the words that Mordechai uses to Esther. Hacharesh, yacharish, if you will surely be silent. So only two times in the entire Torah where it says, if you will be silent. Doubled. So it means, if you will surely be silent. So now let's explain what's going on. Okay, listen to this. The Torah is not written with vowels. So when it's discussing a husband's power to nullify his wife's vow, what if he doesn't say anything? What if he just shuts up for 24 hours and then he says nothing? What happens to the vow? It stands. The wife is finished. Whatever she said, she can't get out of it. It's over for her. So he only has one thing he can do for her. What is that? Stand up and accept it for himself. Do it. But if he doesn't do it, if he's silent, sits it out, it's tantamount to him agreeing with it. So in other words, being silent while the wife does something stupid, and she's walking in front of a car and you're not yelling to her, if you're silent, you're murdering her in a small way. So just like with a person, if someone needs help and you choose to be silent, you're partially, at least on a moral level, responsible for not helping that person, right? So a husband has the power for 24 hours, the Torah says, if your wife makes a dumb vow, you can say something and take it upon yourself so your wife is free from the vow. So how does that relate to Esther? Because this is what Mordechai says to Esther. Im hacharesh tacharishi, Esther, if you will remain silent at a moment like this, then it's over. For the Jews might die. I don't know how they're going to be saved, but you'll be finished. It won't be you. So when you read these words, if you read it without that hey and the dot, it's actually, you ready for this? Esther's reading, because she has the Torah. She's reading, because remember, the reference that Mordechai gives to Esther is loaded. It has that double language. And Esther knows the Torah enough that she knows it has to be written somewhere else. So she's scrambling in her artstral chumash. Where else is it written, im haresh tacharishi? What is Mordechai referring to? And then she comes back to this place with the vows. She says, oh my gosh. Because if I take out that dot in the middle of the hey, you know how you read it? And if in the woman's house she makes a vow and she has the power to nullify the vow. She can say something and nullify the vow. In other words, it's an isha, a woman without that special dot. It's not talking about a husband. It's not her husband does this. Take away that little dot which a Torah doesn't have. And it's speaking about a woman doing this. A woman has the power to step up and say something and save the day. So what woman are we talking about? Esther. So in other words, this is mind-bending. When God ordains this whole bunch of rules about vows, and the husband has the power, it's actually to be understood on two different levels. For us, it's understood what it means. A husband has the power to nullify his wife's vows. But when Esther's looking inside it, she gets the coded message from Mordechai, no, my dear, it's not only talking about some woman, it's you. This whole part of the Torah was written because God is God, and it's a message, it's a coded little message, Esther, that one day in the future, 1,000 years after the Torah is written, you're going to read this without that little dot, and you can't be silent. If you are silent in the face of Haman, in the face of evil, you're agreeing with the evil decree. You can't sit this one out. So being silent is tantamount to supporting the decree. Now what do you say, Esther? So when, what does Esther say? I'm in. Obviously, I had no choice. So do you hear it? So it works on multiple levels. So what was the question we asked at the beginning? Let's go back. We asked, how silly is it that you name the holiday Lottery Day? Purim. Lottery. Like what? Why not, right, the Six-Day War? Why not call it the Day of the Kalashnikov, the Day of the T-55 tank? How silly is it to name a holiday after the failed mechanical weapon of your enemy? It's actually not written about the enemy. How do you know that? I'll read it to you. Ready? This is in Hebrew once again. It only works in Hebrew. I'm sorry. Okay? The first source at the top of the page. OZ Book of Esther, Class Part 6. Ready? But now I'm going to read it to you, and you're going to see the genius of the Megillah. Okay? Ki, because, we're at the top of the page, yeah. Ki Haman ben Hamedata, for Haman the son of Hamedata, Ha'agagi the Agagite, Sorer kol ha'yudim, he was the enemy, the adversary of all of the Jews. Choshav, he devised, ala Yehudim against the Jews, la'abdam, to destroy them. And what did he do? V'hipil pur, he cast a lot. There's that word pur, like Purim. Hu ha-garal, that is the lot, lehumam ula-abdam, to terrify and destroy the Jews. Now we're going to see why it's actually called Purim. Uvivo'ah, and there's that hey again with a dot, oh my gosh. And when she came, but she is a pronoun, who's it referring to? Queen Esther. And when she came, lifnei ha-melech, in front of the king, Amar, to say, to communicate, Al im ha-sefer yashuv machshavato ha-ra'a, to talk about the letters. He commanded through the letters that the evil decree, asher chashav, that he planned al ha-yudim against the Jews, al rosho, instead, it should come back on he, Haman's head, v'talu oto, and to hang him, that banav and his sons, al ha'etz, on the tree. Okay, now, here's the reason why we call Purim. Ready? Follow me. Al kain. Therefore, karu, they called, layamim ha'ela, these days, Purim. Why did they call it Purim? Al shem ha'pur, because of the poor, the lottery. There's only one small problem. The word pur has a second meaning. It means to nullify a decree. Lahafer. Remember we talked about the young lady makes the vow, and the vow is a stupid vow, and the husband has an opportunity to nullify the vow? That word for nullifying a vow in Hebrew is pur. The same shoresh, the same word. So the word pur can mean to Haman a lottery. But to Esther and the Jews, it means to nullify. So the word Purim has a double meaning, just like that verse, whether it's the woman or her husband has a double meaning. Is it applying to Esther or applying to every Jewish woman and husband? It has double level. So the word Purim means lottery, yes, but it also means lehafer, to be mayfair. And the word lehafer or mayfair in Hebrew means to nullify, to cancel out. So the reason we call it Purim, it's very clear. That she, Esther, came in front of the king to cancel the decree of Haman and to hang him on the trees. This is why they call the holiday Purim. So in other words, they're both true. The holiday Purim is named Purim because of the failed attempt by Haman to destroy the Jews using the lottery. That's true. Of course it's true. But additionally, we now learned that that word pur comes from the Hebrew lahafer, pur, to cancel out. Who canceled out what? Esther cancels the evil decree of Haman. So therefore, we look at Purim not from the vantage point of Haman the wicked, but from the vantage point of Esther the good. So in other words, there's a duality to Purim. In the mind of Haman, it's all about chance, coincidence, and lottery. Okay, but my dear Haman, who won the day? Not your chance. It wasn't your coincidence. It wasn't your lottery. In fact, your lottery selected the day where that'll become a great Jewish holiday. Therefore, it's called Purim. To remember that it's in the hands of each individual person. They had freedom of choice. And Esther had a chance to change the world. And Esther courageously went in. She was not silent. And she nullified your evil decree by barging into the king. And eventually the rest of the story is done. Haman, you and your sons hang on a tree. So, wow. So you all see this? So in other words, the Megillah is written, and even the name of the holiday, is written on two different levels. Now, how does that relate to our world today? Because how do you look at things in our world today? Are they coincidence? Are they a roll of the dice? That's the Haman vantage point. What do you think Haman was thinking as he's the black little hood is put over his head? And he's taken out to his 50-foot tall gallows. And he's thinking, I built these gallows. And I built these gallows to hang Mordecai. Well, Haman, how do you feel now? You did it all. You planned everything, right?
Isn't it ironic?
How ironic is it, right? So this is the Jewish point of view. And how does it relate to today? Because it's marvelous. We, in the face of evil, as Jews, know more than any other nation on earth how painful it is, how unbearable it is, when in the face of evil, good men and women do and say nothing. We can't sit it out. We're not sitting out. We came together as a community to talk about it, to protest. Israel, I don't know if you heard this or not, yesterday they have decided to take 25,000, not Jewish, just Ukrainian refugees, and bring them to Israel for as long as they need to be in Israel. Because Israel's in a very difficult position, but on a moral level, Israel's going to do everything in her power to try to help the people. After the class, because Russia, unfortunately, controls the entire northern skies above Syria and Lebanon. They have established actual military air bases there with nuclear-capable bombers stationed there. They have S-400 batteries of SAMs, surface-to-air missiles there. They could take out Israel. They could make Israel. They could just say to Hezbollah, go ahead and attack. And Israel, you're not allowed to shoot down any more Syrian or Hezbollah or Iranian jets. So Israel's in a pickle because on one hand, if she says too much against Russia, I don't know. It's very difficult. But Israel can't remain silent. And I just want everyone to know that as Jews, it is our mission to not remain silent. We have not remained silent. For if you are silent at a moment like this, then evil is allowed to carry on. And in that evil, we would hold, God forbid, part of our soul would bear the iniquity of the evil that is perpetrated. So we should be proud. I don't think we've done enough yet, but we're doing as much as we can right now. And God willing, the Jewish people, America, the world that is righteous is going to do whatever we can to stop this evil, because we know what happens when the world does nothing, when train tracks are not bombed. And there are excuses, right? You read history. How come the Allies couldn't bomb the tracks going to Auschwitz-Birkenau? Easy. They had it in their power. They didn't do it. And because of that, a couple million Jews lost our lives at the end of World War II. So we know how painful, how unbearable it is when the world is quiet and sits it out. But I have to tell you, if the world sits it out, then we're agreeing with whoever the evil despot is. So we can't sit it up. There's only two choices, and we learn it from Esther. Esther, either you do something, but remember, not doing something is tantamount to supporting what the other guy's doing. So God willing, with Hashem's help, this is the month of Purim, right? To cancel the evil decree that through our prayers, Jewish people all over the world, that these evil decrees should be canceled, the evil should be stopped, and the pain and suffering of the poor people in Ukraine should come to a very quick end. So thank you, everyone.